Our guest now has a great passion for bringing difficult stories to listeners' ears. Suzanne Reber is the executive producer and creator of a podcast called Verified, which details the deeds of the Italian policeman, Dino Maoli, who used the couchsurfing website to host young female travellers in his Padua home, drug and sexually assault them. Rather than focus on the sexual predator, Verified talks to the women who came together from different corners of the globe to fight for justice through the Italian court system. The podcast has hit 1 million downloads in the past week. Suzanne has a long history with podcasts. She was the co-creator and former executive editor of Reveal, an award-winning national podcast in the United States. And prior to that, she helped to set up and lead NPR's investigative unit. She's the author of Starlight Tour, The Last Lonely Night of Neil Stonechild, which details the shocking death of a 17-year-old Indigenous boy in Saskatoon, Canada, and the local police practice of driving young native men to the edge of town and abandoning them, so-called starlight tours. Suzanne is with us from Washington, and thank you and welcome. Can you hear me, Suzanne? We appear to have a bit of a connection problem there. Or is it just me?
I think I'm here.
You're here. There we go.
Here.
Thank you, Suzanne. It happened a while ago, and my guests could hear me and I couldn't hear them, and I was just talking all over the top of them. So great that we've got it straight. Welcome.
Yeah, it's a sign of our times, right? Everybody gets on Zoom and the first thing they say is, can you hear me? So here I am. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. This podcast, Verified, look, the numbers tell you a story. It's been launched in the middle of the pandemic. So how difficult was it getting it completed and uploaded practically?
Well, you know, in terms of our launch, of course, we could never have predicted that we would launch and a few weeks later all this would be happening. In fact, when we launched our show February 24th, our reporters, who of course are from Italy, were already locked down. So we were probably more aware than most people what was going to come at us. And of course, the U.S., as you've probably reported on your news, has you know, had a fairly slow reaction at the beginning. Certainly that's what it feels like when you're living here. But so launching in the middle of a pandemic has been a little rough. But I think what we've found out from our audience and the reactions we've had on our social channels, you know, we have like very active social channels, is that people are still being moved by the story. And I think there's, in spite of the fact that it's a pretty dark story, there's obviously some pretty violent things that happen. There's an inspiration that comes with listening to the stories of these young women who fought for, you know, 7 years to get to the courts. And I think we're hearing from a lot of listeners that this is actually inspiring them. And there's sort of a resilience to these women and the reporters that people are finding quite inspiring right at the moment.
It is remarkable, their contribution. So often in our legal systems, the voice of women or the voice of anyone offended against is not heard. And as you say, it's all about the perpetrator and their versions of events. What is extraordinary is the cooperation you have here in the telling of this story. You're the creator of the project. How did you get involved in it?
Well, you know, it's I'm part of a community of investigative reporters and editors across the world we call ourselves kind of a bit of a tribe. We meet up at conferences, we do trainings with each other. So I had known the Italian reporters, Alessia, Giulio, and Cecilia for some years. And so we had just been musing, they had interest in doing a podcast. So a couple of years ago in the spring of 2018, I went over to Italy to work with them. They wanted to do some workshops to see if they could, you know, do their own podcast. And so as a result of that workshop that I went over there to do, they were pitching me different stories. And, you know, there were a lot of stories that just weren't really suitable for what is a serialized format. You need a really big story with lots of plot and lots of characters. Not every story can make it work that way. But they told me about this story they'd worked on, and they had actually published a story in 2015 of this perpetrator, Dino Maglio. At that time, the women had already come forward, but of course, there had not yet been this path to justice that we really document in our podcast. And so they showed me this story and they'd say, well, you know, this story's kind of old, but there's a trial coming up. And it's, and I read the story and I was just immediately gripped. And I said, look, guys, this is the story we have to do. This is absolutely perfect for a podcast because there's a journey for the listener that you can actually really follow along a real life. It's a true crime story with a twist. It's not in the past. It's not a cold case. It's actually happening as we speak. It's not even done. So for a listener, if you're going to stick around for a 10-episode podcast, it just puts you on a journey that's real. And I think that's what grabbed me about the story right away. The fact that these women, when this happened to them, were quite young. I'm the mother of two daughters who are still in their 20s as we speak. And these young women were in their early 20s when all this happened to them. And I just was so inspired by the fact that they didn't take no for an answer. They decided that they were, you know, they were essentially assaulted, you know, they were assaulted, they were abused. They didn't feel that they got any justice from the police. The police didn't believe them. So they had to come together themselves and they used every tool they could. They went on Facebook, they had WhatsApp, and they just banded together and decided to kind of do their own investigation and find justice that way.
So at the start,
for me, it was a no-brainer.
Yeah. At the start of the project, though, you had a second trial coming. I think a new trial coming. No idea how that was going to go, and actually, you didn't even know that the women would agree to talk to you either.
Yes, I mean that was the prerequisite, and I knew that. You know, I knew the three reporters, the European reporters, had built a lot of trust with their sources. Obviously, these were their sources. They had spent many years working with them to get to where they were at that point. And I said, we can do a pitch to Stitcher, which is the company that has produced this, the production house that I work with. And they I knew that, you know, unless we can get actual women to speak to us, then obviously we can't really do a podcast. You can't really do a podcast without the cooperation. So what surprised me, though, is we right away, we got the early cooperation of a few key characters who you'll meet in the podcast. A woman from Montana called Kate, a young woman from Portugal whose name is Maria, and also a woman from Australia who is unique because she was, unlike the others, she was a mother. She was traveling with her two daughters. And so she was very very different in the sense that she was not drugged. She was very aware of what had happened. But her younger daughter, who at the time was a minor, she had been raped by Dino Maglio while they were staying in his home. So that was the, you know, those were the three key women who agreed to speak with us. But then as we were going into production, actually more and more women came forward and were willing to cooperate with us. Some of them did speak on mic and we were able to hear their voices. Others helped us in behind the scenes. But a lot of the women who went to court in this trial really did work with us. So there were 14 in all that ended up in this trial in Italy. And we have many of them on the record. And that was a unique thing. Because, you know, at the time in 2015, when the first stories came out and they went all over the world, they were published in many newspapers, including The Guardian and South China Morning Post, Australia, CBC. The women at that point were anonymized. They had not yet decided to go on the record. But for our show, they did. So this is what makes it so special.
Yes. It has many elements, as you say. Their youth, the fact they're travelling, and this always catches the attention of media and of people, doesn't it, with this kind of crime. The vulnerability of people travelling, but also the freedom that we want people to have to do it. So these are stories that so often will capture people's interests. Their banding together and their seeking of justice is obviously a standout. The other thing is it's part of our new and modern world, the sharing economy and couch surfing. And goodness, these crimes are committed in just about every circumstance you can think of. But this was the methodology of this particular offender. Could you tell us a little bit more about what they all went through and his modus operandi?
Right. So the story, as I said, is it takes place in Italy, and all of our various women who came from all over the world, they were attracted, obviously, to the allure of Italy. We all have this romantic image of Italy, and they wanted to travel there on a budget, and they became part of couch surfing. And couch surfing is it's essentially like Airbnb, except for it's a little bit more like visiting with a local. No money changes hands, and you're essentially billeting with somebody. And so they went, and what was interesting about Dino is he immediately wrote, he would often advertise himself like, I'm in Padua, I'm really close to Venice. Venice is expensive. It's only a 30-minute train ride away, you know, come to Padua. He had a very extensive profile, hundreds of reviews. And again, in our system right now, we put so much faith in check marks and trusted marks and verification and all of this stuff. And of course, he was super verified. In fact, one of our women called him that. He was super verified. And they trusted him. And in fact, the other reason they trusted him was because he was a police officer. So he had a lot of levels. He would often be a tour guide for a day or so. And then usually after a day of being, the nice guy, then things started to take a turn. And his methods were that he basically drugged many of his victims, and some of them were also raped.
How did things begin for the pursuit of justice? And we won't go through everything that happens in the podcast, but I think these initial steps will really help people understand the people they're going to meet. The first move, told in the podcast anyway, was one of the women who went into the positive reviews of this host and contacted the poster and started asking whether anything had gone wrong during the stay. I mean, they literally began their own investigation.
That's true. And so you're talking about Maria. So what's really sad about what Dino did is when you take away somebody's ability to make decisions through the use of drugs, you often also wipe out a lot of their memories. A lot of these women reported having fragmented memories, not being able to really remember what had happened. Often they would leave, they would feel something off, but they would start remembering things. So when Maria got home back to Portugal, she just knew that something really bad had happened to her, and she could not let it go. So she tried to find out. First, she tried to contact Dino. She wrote to him, and he ignored her. She just wanted to find out more. So she went on the couchsurfing platform, and she couldn't really find any negative reviews. But she started figuring out that, what if I looked at the neutral reviews? And she wrote to in a very open-ended way, which, as an investigative editor, I found very, very interesting, that she didn't give up her story. She just said, did anything strange happen to you while you were there? So she gave people their own agency to tell her story. And so many people wrote back. And that's how she figured out there were other women. And her friend Miriam, who is also in the podcast, they were like sleuths. I mean, they are amazing investigators. Hats off to them. I do this for a living, but they are very good investigators. And they got in touch with some of these women and eventually set up a private Facebook group so they could have a safe space where they could talk to each other. And they started to realize that a lot of the women that contacted them had had way worse experiences than even they did. And that's how it all began. And there was a moment in time where these women were so desperate to find out what had happened to them that they were even thinking of going back to Padua and kind of doing some elaborate sting operation, which was very dangerous. And that's really when Maria's boyfriend at the time, Arnes, decided, wait, this is way too crazy. This is too dangerous. That is not a good idea. And it was actually Arnes and Maria who then decided that perhaps they should reach out to the media in Italy and see if they could get some help, because they'd already been to the police that basically blew them off. They now had this group of women who wanted to fight back and find a way through to, basically, they say this is a quote, take Dino down. And they got the help of the reporters. So they wrote to them on email, and that's how they met the reporters, and just said, look, we need help. What can we do? And at that point, then it became kind of the women and the reporters, and they started continuing to investigate until eventually they found out that, you know, Dino had been arrested. And that's when they realized that things were speeding up, and there was a first trial. And that's, you know, everything changed when Belinda, the mother I mentioned from Australia, she basically reported Dino for the very first time. And she went all the way to Venice to do it because she didn't trust the police in Padua. She didn't know if Dino perhaps had, you know, associates in the police service there. So they were the first people to report him as a rapist. And from there on, it got a little bit more complicated because the first trial was really just one woman, you know, the daughter of Belinda. And then it took many years for the second trial of the multiple women of the 14 others to come to trial. And that took place in 2018, in the fall of 2018.
It's been a never-ending journey for these women, this journey for justice. And goodness, one can only imagine personally for each individual what they have gone through over these years, let alone collectively as a group. How would you characterise that as best you can as an observer and someone who works with them?
Well, obviously, I think of it as a privilege to tell this story, and I know a lot of creators say that, but in this case, you know, you've got all these women who've already been through this long journey, but they were determined to see if their story could get a wider audience because they do feel that sort of a moment in time where a lot of us will, without thinking much, get into an Uber, we rent Airbnbs, we don't think too much about how we've come to trust these various systems of verification. And so there's definitely a universal message that they felt, you know, there's something, we just feel we want to tell people our story. And the respect that comes with that is us being aware that while some of this happened in the past, a lot of it happened in a, you know, in a very relatively short, you know, basically a year ago. And so they are still on the journey and we are now on the journey with them. So what was important for me as an editor is to always be aware that they are living it again. And we talked a lot in our meetings about ongoing consent. So when you are working with a trauma survivor, you have to be very aware that people might agree to one thing one day and it may not be, they might not be as comfortable with it 3 months from now. So we had to be very aware that we are talking about people who, some of whom are very traumatized. They're all dealing with it at different times. But in fact, what we found is they became even more emboldened through the process of the production. And we found that they were, they've been feisty all along, but they're very feisty still. And I found a lot of inspiration from working with them.
You did something interesting with this podcast. You had photos that people could text in if they wanted to see the photos. It became a kind of an interactive text experience. What was that about and what questions did it raise for the women?
Right, yeah. So I think that, again, in podcasting, it's a very intimate medium, audio. I mean, you're a radio person as well, so you know how intimate it is. And we just felt that we know from the audience that I had worked on another show that I did called Sold in America, and we just, the interactivity, the text bot, and being able to, for the audience to directly be able to talk to the creators, we knew it was a powerful thing. So we decided we would try it again for this because we had a feeling that people might want to tell us their stories or they would want to share what had happened to them. We heard from many, many women through our texting that told us that similar things had happened to them. They thanked us for doing the story. So there was that level of interaction. And a lot of people obviously wanted to know who these people were. It's a very contemporary story. It's not historical. So we shared what we could. We couldn't share everything. We didn't share the images of every woman. again, it had to do with ongoing consent. We shared what we were able to do. We had, of all of the texting, I mean, thousands of people were, you know, interacting with us through our text service. We only had, I think I wrote it down, basically we only had about 20 people who opted out over the whole period. So once people were engaged, they kind of stayed with us. We had a few comments on, you know, is this really appropriate? You know, these women are survivors. But to be honest, the majority of our listeners and texters are just really engaged with the content. And they just want to know these women. So we felt that it was a very contemporary thing we could do, and it would actually bring the audience closer to the story. And so it's just been super successful. Not everybody agrees with it, of course, but for us, it was a way, because we actually didn't just want to do a website. And the reason, you know, I didn't want to do a website is because there's so many spoilers. I kind of wanted the journey to be real. So I felt that if people are consuming and they want to engage with this text number, then it's more in the moment. You know, they're actually learning as they go versus, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen a book, you know, nonfiction book. Some people go right to the end and they look at all the pictures, but then it's a kind of a way to give up the story, right? So if you're trying to keep somebody on your journey for 10 episodes, which is essentially 5 hours of programming, then I was very aware I didn't want to give up all the story right away. So that was one of the reasons I did that.
Are you able to moderate that interaction so that you're not getting trolls or others?
Yes. We all personally answer all the messages on GroundSource, which is our partner for the texting service. I answer most of them myself. You know, I can honestly say we have other social channels. I can tell you them later at the end, but we had a few trolls at the very beginning and then they went away. I can honestly tell you we were moderating it so carefully that we just had a problem for a few days and then it stopped. So
what of Dino, and again, without wanting to give the whole story away, for those who are going to enjoy the podcast, can I say, did right. you get to talk to him? Did you want to talk to him? Did you get to talk to him?
We, of course, wanted to talk to him. We really have been trying all along through the trial, after the verdict. We extended several letters through his lawyer, who we met up with in Padua, invitations for him to speak with us. At one point, he said he would do it, and then he withdrew that offer. We just actually last week reached out to him again because we're just wrapping up our update episodes right now. And we asked again, and they said, no, this is not possible at the moment. So, yes, we would like to speak with him, but so far that has not worked out.
Suzanne Reber is our guest. We are talking about her latest podcast. She's an investigative journalist. Her latest podcast, Verified. You are listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. 10:30 it is. What draws you to this kind of reporting and storytelling? What motivates it?
You know, I've been asked that before, and it's kind of tricky because I started in journalism, and I like the idea of actually just talking to people. That was what first attracted me to journalism, the idea of actually kind of getting to know people, connecting. And so one of my first jobs at Canadian Broadcasting, where I worked for many years, was I was actually a field producer. And I just found the idea of being in the field, connecting with people who were going through incredible experiences. I was lucky enough to be part of some big events like the Berlin Wall coming down and various, you know, world events like that. And I just felt that being really getting to know sources was something that was super important to me in journalism. And, you know, once I gave up foreign correspondence because, you know, it was harder to do when I had my girls, for me, I just basically decided I had to do something really in-depth. And so investigative reporting drew me. And I was lucky to have some mentors early on who taught me some of the kind of the craft skills of investigative reporting. But what I like about these stories is that they allow you to go really deep. And So much of journalism is can sometimes be very surface, and obviously we need the daily news. We need to know what's going on. We want to know in the morning when we wake up what's happening in our world. But there's obviously it tends to be it just doesn't allow you to tell every layer. So I've just pushed the format as far as I could. Investigative reporting, always like, can I write a book? Can I write a play? Is there some other new storytelling thing I can get into that allows me to go deeper? So I guess that was my main draw, is to see if I could really explore stories and try and tell as many of the angles as possible, trying to really get to know a person and the complexity of human beings versus the more kind of superficial level that we sometimes have to do when we're covering the daily news.
It's been 15 years since your book Starlight Tour, The Last Lonely Night of Neil Stonechild, was published, and I think coming up to 30 years since his death. Who was he? What was his story?
So, well, Neil was a teenager, and he lived in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which is one of the Canadian provinces in the middle of the country, Neil was an Aboriginal boy, and he basically, on a really cold night in the November of 1990, he went out, he disappeared, and he basically was seen the last time one of his friends saw him. He was in the back of a police cruiser, banging on the window, saying, you know, help me, help me. And he was then found several days later on the outskirts of Saskatoon, and he had frozen to death. And so what was clear to his family when he was found is that they already knew, because many people in the Indigenous community, this was not a secret. This was something that they knew about, the Starlight Tours. It was talked about all the time. This is when the police, they have the right to arrest you, of course. They can put you in the cruiser, but the law basically requires you to take that person to the police station and arrest them or do whatever. The law does not allow you to drop them off at the edge of town and just dump them like human trash. So the Starlight Tour had been talked about in those circles and those families, but proving it and essentially getting the cops to be convicted never happened. The two police officers who were found to have had Neil in the back of their car when he disappeared have never been charged. But there was a public inquiry held that found them to have had him in the back of the car. I just found, you know, I had been in South Africa as a reporter, and there was something about the story. I just found it shocking, this idea of officers taking the law into their own hands in this brutal way and using kind of the cold temperatures of Canada, death by Canada, I sometimes call it, to basically drop people off. And obviously you're not going to survive in those temperatures. But it's a pretty insidious crime in the sense that it also destroys evidence. There's usually no witness. There's no weapon. A frozen body. It's just very hard to prove, who committed the crime. So this was a story that I became aware of when, first we had Neil happen in 1990, but then in the year 2000 there were a whole bunch of drop-offs in a very, very short period of time. And at that point, I was already in charge of an investigative team. And I dispatched one of our reporters there. I said, what is going on in Saskatoon? We have to investigate. But as you know, in a lot of Indigenous communities, when there's a crime like this, the community often retreats and doesn't really want to speak to reporters. So we didn't really get much at that point. We couldn't really figure out much. But a couple of years later, I kind of dug in again. And then after that, you know, I spent 3 years researching the story and writing the book on my own time with my co-author, Robert Renault.
It is patient, diligent work. Thank you for your time again, Suzanne Reba. And Verified is the podcast we have been discussing for much of the interview. It is available now through various podcast platforms.